This is Geek Muse, episode 42, recorded Sunday, September 10th, 2006. Welcome to Geek Muse, podcasting from geekmuse.net. That's geekmuse.net. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to Geek Muse. This is Nemschleck. No, we are not dead. We've been taking a little bit of a break here, and we did record an episode, and it wasn't a very good episode, so we decided to junk that, and we'll be talking about some older news this episode, but we're just trying to catch up on some of the stuff that we talked about before and skipped. And joining me tonight is Chris Grant. How's it going, Chris?
Hey, Nim. It's going well. It's that night again.
Yes, it's podcast night again. Excellent. And actually, football season's back on, so I'm actually rather happy about that because I'm a little bit of a football fan. But at any rate, also joining us tonight is Travis Crow.
Hello, and I'm here, and in my new place, I've got brand spanking new internet installed finally, so I don't have to travel anywhere to do the podcast. I can do it right here from the comfort of my bedroom.
Now, you're getting, 7 megabits down and about 400 kilobits up, right?
Yeah, for $29.95 a month, if you believe that.
That's pretty nice. Well, you know, I am still frustrated, though, because my own internet service that I have, Chris and I live relatively close to each other. He pays a little bit extra a month to get 5 megabits down and 1 megabit up, and I have the slower service of just 1.5 megabits down and 1 megabit up. And, it's nice to see that, the down speed is always increasing. But, it kind of sucks for somebody like us because, I would be more than happy to actually serve out our audio for the podcast from home. But with a 1 megabit connection, I just can't do it, And I know there isn't as much of a demand on upgoing or upstream bandwidth as there is for downstream bandwidth, but I would hope that the companies sooner or later would increase that.
Yeah, for some of us, there is. And for a lot of us, we'd be happily willing to pay for it, but you really can't. There's not even an option. The only option available to you is to go through and get a business account, which is stupid to begin with, to partition your customers in that way, because the only reason to do it is to charge businesses a great deal more for the exact same service that you get to residential customers. But at that point, the price jump is so egregious that, it's not even feasible. So It's a pity that there aren't even any options even available.
And why the hell are static IPs so freaking expensive? I don't get that either.
I looked into that, and you also have to have a business account to do that. And the difference between the service I have now, which is 7 down, 384 up, with no static IPs, to a business account, which is, I think, 5 megabits down and 1 megabit up with a block of 3 static IPs, I think that was $280 a month.
Holy shit. Wow. Our local cable company here has, many subscribers, and their rates, they get 3 megabits down and 200 kilobits per second up, which is barely anything. But if you want static IPs, you have to get a business account, and it's 3 times as much. It's about $100 for their low-end business account. Now, I actually go through Quest for my DSL, and they have a thing. It's not too bad. It is still expensive, though. It's $15 for a chunk of 8 static IP addresses, of which 3 are used. One of them is your local router, and 2 of them are used on their side. So you get 5 devices that you can actually put in your location that have static IP addresses. And if you want, and you can get another chunk of 8 after that, which I think you actually get to use all 8 in the second chunk, though, for another $15 a month. But that's still, that'd be $30 a month for 13 IP addresses, which is pretty fucking expensive, actually.
Yeah, who I'm through now is with Time Warner Cable.
Chris, do you know of any other services in town, or have you looked into this at all on getting other providers here in town and getting some sort of a business account set up?
Well, I think really we're still talking the most economical for static IPs, I think, is still going to be, you know, going through your local telco and DSL. Cable modems, you know, there's sort of this religious argument between cable modems and DSL besides. I'd much rather have my phone company screw me over than my cable company screw me over, because at least with my phone company I get stable internet and my cable company is new to this whole digital stuff. So maybe it's more stable elsewhere, but I've heard lots of people have issues with cable modem providers, and then I wouldn't want to rely on them for a business account besides. So I would rather get it from a phone company. Now, there are other people that do wireless, you know, that do microwave wireless. If you've got line of sight to their tower, you can do that, and that doesn't end up being too expensive. But then again, your static IPs, it's really kind of hit and miss how you get that and how much it's going to be. In my experience, it's been best to just use a dynamic DNS provider and just do DHCP and have I've got a program running on my machine called what is it called? Direct something. I'll look up the name. But it's $15 for life, and it checks your IP like every however you want it to and however often you want it to, and it goes out and changes the dynamic DNS. So, you know, my IP might change once every 6 months or once every 3 months. It really doesn't matter. It just changes it on the fly, and then you don't have to worry about it. So I'd say go that route if you don't really have to rely on it. And for home use, you really don't have to. It's just convenient.
Yeah, I looked into DSL when I was looking who I should go through here in San Antonio, and the bandwidth difference is remarkable, because I think the fastest that I could get through DSL was 4 megabits down and like 128K up, or maybe it was 256, but it wasn't very good. It was significantly more, too. I think it was like $50 or $60 a month. Whereas with this, I said it's 7 megabits down, and I actually do get, when I test it, I get about 6.6 megabits. So that's with the overhead.
That's a good point, Trav. It's, you know, there's some smaller DSL providers that I've seen that charge a whole lot more, too. But, I mean, they even charge a whole lot more for just their landline service. So even that's kind of a hit and miss for pricing. Some of the big telcos, I think, are actually doing better at that than the smaller ones.
Yeah, it really depends on what's available in your particular area.
Yeah, but isn't one of the problems with cable modem, though, is that if your neighbor is downloading something and you're downloading something, aren't you then sharing that 7 megabits? I know they can partition that off somewhat, and they'll analyze like traffic patterns for certain neighborhoods and put in some sort of a splitter of some sort to split that bandwidth up. But isn't there some sort of sharing going on? Isn't that how the cable technology works?
I think that it used to be that way, and truthfully, I don't know, but I don't think that's really the case much anymore. I'll have to look into it, because actually, I remember hearing that as well when cable internet was starting to gain steam. I remember hearing about how there was a certain amount of bandwidth allotted for, you know, a group that was usually about a block or so, and that if somebody was using a bunch of it, then everybody else got to suffer as well. I don't know if that's still the case anymore, though. I think that they are able to do traffic shaping a lot better than they used to, but I don't know.
One way to test that is to do a speed test periodically throughout the day, because if you do a speed test at like 10 or midnight, 10 o'clock at night or midnight, you should probably get almost your full 7 megabits. But if you're doing it at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, from my experience as a systems administrator, that is the peak time of the day, is 2 p.m. That's when the most people are on the internet, that's when the most people are doing stuff, and see what your bandwidth is like right at 2 p.m. and see if you still get close to 7 megabits then. If you do, then great. But if you don't, then yuck.
Well, I haven't... I do a speed test every so often just because, I don't know, I'm curious. And I would say that, not sure how often I do it, maybe about twice a week, you know, just for kicks. And I haven't noticed any significant differences neither here nor in New Braunfels, where I was for about the last 6 months or so. The speeds seem to be pretty consistent.
The program I was talking about that's $15 for life is called Direct Update, and it works really, really well, and it works with probably 90% of the dynamic DNS providers out there, by the way, so works really well.
Now, the only concern I would have with that, and I know you run a domain out of your house and you use that for that, but if you do go down and DNS has a TTL, a time to live, which can be up to 24 hours. And so if you were to reset your modem and your DNS, you know, needed to get updated, it may take people a day to get back to you. Now, I don't think you're having, you know, you don't have that all high of an availability need, so that's not so much of a concern for you. But for me, being down for a day would be unacceptable. So I pay the $15 a month for statics.
Well, and you could run into that regardless, because DNS as a whole, even though your TTL is set to a certain amount by your DNS provider, and the DNS provider, in a dynamic DNS standpoint, is going to be very low because that's what they're geared to do, and they can handle the extra DNS traffic that comes from having a low time to live on that DNS record. But it really depends on which DNS server is caching your record. So you might run into that problem no matter when your IP changes, and you're by having a static IP, you're guaranteeing that it won't change, so therefore you will never have that issue. I guess like AOL, for instance, is infamous for ignoring the TTL entirely and just keeping DNS records however long they feel like keeping them. And there are other DNS services or other DNS servers out there that do that, but most of them do pay attention to the TTL, and they try to make it more and more and more low so that the dynamic stuff works correctly.
Well, in the same vein as speed of service versus actual speed of service, like I said, I get 7 megabits down, but it actually turns out to be about 6.6 to 6.2, depending. Nem, you deal a lot more with networking hardware than I do. Do you notice certain devices that perform better than others, like on the consumer level, with respect to routers and modems, that sort of thing? Because there's a lot of different routers out there, from Linksys and D-Link and Belkin and whoever, and they come at all sorts of different prices. As far as performance, is there a lot of overhead from one to another that you know of?
Well, Chris would know a lot about this as well, and I'll say, not that I've ever noticed. Usually when you get a 100 megabit or a gigabit switch, and by the way, I do have a little story about a gigabit switch, but usually those are very reliable, and that's very proven, very known technology. I know I've had some problems with some 3COM internet cards, just NICs that you put into your box. A network interface card. The only problems that I have noticed were not at all on a performance level, but rather just a hardware level, because all the access points, the wireless access points and the routers and all this kind of stuff, it's been in a booming industry for several years, and they keep getting cheaper and better, but still they're still rather cheaply produced pieces of equipment. And so I've had several pieces of equipment go out on me, typically usually power related in some way, like the power adapter will go out. I did recently, though, buy a Linksys 8-port gigabit switch, and I'll go look up that model number and put it up in the show notes here, because I want to tell my listeners to avoid that switch. Not because it performed poorly. It performed quite well. The only problem was it has an extremely noisy fan in it. And I already have 4 computers around me all the time when I'm in my house, and I don't want yet another device making a lot of noise, especially not when I have an 8-port 100 megabit switch that is completely quiet, and I replace it with a gigabit switch, which is noisier than hell. I was rather unhappy with this, so I actually did tear it apart and pulled the fan off of it, replaced it with a slower yet quieter fan, and unfortunately, after some months, and I have no idea how this happened, one of the blades in that fan cracked and stopped the fan, and I don't know how long it was operating as such, again, because it was so quiet, and one day, just my 8-port gigabit switch was just sitting there dead. So I can turn it on and the power light comes on, but none of the ports work. So some circuitry in there got fried. But I don't know. I have not noticed much of any of a performance enhancement between anything. Although, you never know. I mean, if you have a lot of traffic from various different sites going through a switch, the cache on the switch can make a little bit of a difference. But I think Chris would know a lot more about that than I would.
Well, the only reason, the reason I ask is because when I was working retail, I would get people who would come in and say, I want to exchange this router for a different one because, you know, blah, 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 blah. My network was such and such fast before I got this, and then I put this on it, and it's such and such fast, and that's unacceptable, and I want to get a different brand. And, you know, I mean, I can't argue with them because I don't care. But I found that really hard to believe that you know, there can be that much of a difference between one router to another, because it's not like it's doing that difficult of a job where what it's doing is going to be non-negligible to the time that it takes a packet to get from one place to another. And furthermore, I wouldn't imagine that the difference between one to another is going to be that big, because regardless of the manufacturer, the components are all made in Taiwan anyway.
Yeah, I was just about to say the exact same thing. 90% of this hardware has all the same chipsets in it, all the same hardware. It's just a different plastic covering on the outside, and sometimes it looks shiny and sometimes it doesn't and whatnot. You know, my guess again is that those people who were complaining about the speed differential were probably going throughout different times of the day, and you never know, too. Consumers are somewhat unknowledgeable about this stuff. I mean, if I go and I test my DSL router, and it tells me I get 1.2 megabits down, where I'm supposed to be getting 1.5, well, you know, that's close. That's close to what I'm supposed to be getting. And I don't know, maybe somebody was, you know, trying to contact me at the same time, or maybe, you know, whatever server I was using to do my speed test was a bit slowed down just then and couldn't deliver all the packets in a timely manner. You know, the internet is a very dynamic beast. It changes throughout the day, and there are a myriad number of variables that affect, you know, the time for one packet to get from host A to host B. And I would have been curious to have talked to those consumers and asked them, well, you know, what are you basing that on? And they're saying, oh, well, it took 5 seconds to load this web page before, now it takes 6 seconds. Well, you know, who knows? Maybe that other server is being slow right now. You know,
yeah.
your metrics are so variable, you can't determine. But that hardware is so consistent that I doubt it was the hardware.
Yeah, typically they would babble about ping times and stuff, and I just wouldn't even have the time to argue with them, because invariably they're going to assume that you're an idiot and that they know better than you do, so I'm not even going to bother.
Well, and there is some, you know, potential truth, but it would be so rare that it would come out to be an issue that, you know, I can't imagine. For instance, there's some applications that go out and tweak your network or the registry for your network settings, like MTU, which is, you know, maximum transmission unit of the packets going out of your machine. And sometimes if you have different network devices that are talking different MTUs, it'll cause problems and make it inefficient. But generally speaking, I can't imagine that would be an issue for the large amount of the population.
Yeah, absolutely. And also to get back to what Travis was just saying, ping times are notoriously unreliable, and ping wasn't really meant to determine, you know, network bandwidth. I mean, it shows you network latency, which is actually something quite different from network bandwidth. You know, the number of hops it has to go through is a determining factor in that, and that may not be as much of a factor with bandwidth. So ping is great for, like, hey, is that machine actually up? And if you get a response, yay. That's what ping was meant to do. That's what people should use it for, not for doing any sort of networking metrics.
There's a really good Wikipedia article that I'll have to put in the show notes that discusses latency and throughput of the internet and the speeds of which, you know, and how they affect, you know, perceived speed. And in the article, somebody, one of the authors of the article, did some testing on how long does it take for a packet to get to and from, you know, from like Los Angeles to England and back, and how does that compare to the maximum theoretical speed that the packet could possibly take. And using Ethernet, we've actually got it down to where the latency on a good pipe is only about 30% faster, or 30% slower than the speed of light, which is the theoretical cap of... It ain't going to go faster than that. And so, you know, the latency of the internet is incredible if you get a good pipe. So, you know, that just, I don't know where I'm going with this, but that just kind of relates to our conversation of, you know, does the router make a difference? And apparently we've got this technology down pretty good.
Well, you know, that's really interesting, actually, because Ethernet is... a rather odd protocol, actually, and it was, you know, back in the day, there were the when Ethernet came about, there was, in fact, I think Ethernet actually was one of the very first networking protocols that came out, but there was, IBM had a thing called Token Ring, which was basically only one machine could talk at a time within a certain local area network, and they'd pass this token from one to the other, and if you had the token, then you could send stuff out, but if you didn't have the token, you couldn't, so you had to wait for the token to come around again. I mean, it kind of worked okay. It solved some problems and didn't solve others. And then, of course, there was ATM, which I think is somewhat died. I don't know. They do still use ATM in a lot of backbones in various corporations or large campuses. But Ethernet really is a bunch of people shouting in a room. If you don't know what Ethernet is or how it works, I can quickly describe it for you. Take 100 people and put them in one big room, and they just shout out at each other, like, hey, hey. And, you know, basically the idea is that if you keep the packet size is actually pretty big though too, but it's basically anybody just talks whenever they want to. If two people talk at the same time, then a collision occurs and they both wait a random amount of time and try to talk again. And that's basically Ethernet, and it actually works quite well. So it's interesting.
Well, that's using collision avoidance, collision detection. Was it CACD? There's other schemes as well, aren't there?
That's the one I've always heard about. So I don't know if there are other schemes.
I'm inclined to think that when I was going to MCSE school, that they were discussing different other schemes to use as well. Maybe I must be thinking about Token Ring. I'm an idiot. Forget about me.
Yeah, and I'm not sure either, actually.
Well, and actually, collisions are much less prevalent nowadays, because back in the day, pretty much everybody used a hub. So what we were talking about there is, again, you know, like having, let's just say 10 people. 10 people in a room, and they're trying to talk to each other, and none of them are very courteous, and so they just shout out whatever they're thinking whenever they're thinking it, and hopefully nobody is talking at that time, and that the other person can then hear them. But if we're using a switch, then what we're talking about there is that you are actually able to somewhat much more specifically talk to the person that you want to talk to, especially, and you can actually like basically whisper in each other's ear. So if machine A wants to talk to machine B, they can actually talk to each other without influencing any of the communications going on elsewhere.
Well, speaking of routers, there's a router that ASUS is coming out with that integrates all sorts of shit that does a lot more than your standard router, and well, maybe this factors into performance. Apparently, it's got a built-in hard drive, it supports BitTorrent, it supports sharing over iTunes, and what else does it do?
It's got, it does UPnP, which is a sharing protocol that my DVD player actually uses, and
FTP.
FTP, Samba. It has three USB ports, so you can hook up either pen drives or more external hard drives to get even more throughput. It has a web server built into it, plus a firewall, because it is a router. And it's $250. You get like this, it's almost like most of what people do for networking all combined into one box that's also your wireless router. So it's pretty kick-ass, actually.
Yeah, and it can do
RAID,
too.
What else should a server do? Yeah, exactly. It's doing everything that a server would do, except it's basically it's not exactly just a router, because it's got a hard drive in it and an OS.
Exactly, and it comes with a 160 gig hard drive, which isn't too shabby. You know, that's plenty space for most consumers out there. And I'm looking at this thing and thinking this is the ultimate dorm room gadget, you know, or the ultimate college kid gadget. But maybe I should limit it to just college kids. But you know, because I'm thinking along the lines of people who have a laptop. Because if you have a home machine, that's a desktop machine that you leave on 24/7, this you pretty much have all this technology in there. You've got a web browser. You can do some web serving if you want to set up the dynamic DNS like we were talking about earlier, and you can do BitTorrent and iTunes and all that jazz. But, this is all contained in one nice little box, and if you're a laptop person, this is going to be awfully sweet because you can set up your torrents to download. You can even go in and set up, FTP URLs or just web URLs to download. So let's say you're trying to download, like Oracle from Oracle's website, which is actually free for developer use. You can just set it up in this little router and shut your laptop and go to bed, and it just merrily keeps downloading away. So It's fucking kick ass. It's really nice to see integration like this. I don't know what OS is running on there. I'm assuming it's some variant of Linux. And this actually came out several weeks ago. And at one point, I had found a website that had a whole crapload of screenshots from this guy. And I was looking for it today and couldn't find it. But hopefully, by the time we get the editing done on this episode, I'll be able to find that URL and put that in the show notes, so you can just get a little bit of an idea of what it looks like. But I don't know. You know, I've been sticking with just a wireless access point. That's all it does. No router, no nothing. But I'm looking at this guy, and I'm like, man, that would be awfully convenient to have something that can do everything that this thing can do.
Well, but I think that its convenience is really limited, like you said, to either dorm rooms or people who just have a laptop and they don't have a machine that's at home running all the time. Because my experience is that when you cram a bunch of stuff into a device that you don't have a good interface for, then it just introduces all sorts of ways that things can go wrong. And so if I've got a machine that's at home that is, I mean, a computer that's at home and is always on the network, then I would rather configure all these things to happen on that, where I've got, you know, a good interface to control it, rather than trying to manage all of this through what I assume would be a web-based interface to try to manage all that. It seems like a lot of complexity that would introduce lots of ways that things can not work.
Well, you are correct. It is a web interface to configure it, and also if you want to set up any downloads on it, either BitTorrent or Web or FTP, then yes, you do use a web interface, and it is also limited. I believe it is 7 simultaneous downloads. If we have any BitTorrent users out there, I'm pretty sure you know you can hit 7 simultaneous torrents pretty darn quickly, especially if you like TV shows or something along those lines. And I've also heard that the BitTorrent interface or the BitTorrent client built into it is a little bit spotty. It crashes every now and then, or just it'll stop downloading something even after 50%, and just for some reason it'll just stop, and there's no real reason. You just got to start it up again and have it continue going. But a lot of the other stuff that it does, you know, having Samba and FTP and web built into it, so you can use it as a local files, you know, storage device that's a network attached. And again, if you have a UPnP device, then you can watch movies or music off of it, or photos. That's UPnP does all three. Or iTunes, again, you can put your iTunes files on there and share them around on your various laptop devices via iTunes. I mean, none of those use a web interface. I mean, those are all using standard protocols. So the only thing you really need the web interface for is adding those downloads.
Well, if somebody were to write a rich client, you know, using some multi-platform language like Python or what have you, you know, then, you know, if the router had an API that you could just write a client that's a lot easier to use, that would mitigate a lot of those problems.
And that should be fairly trivial to do. I mean, how many web libraries are, you know, libraries are out there for working with the web? You know, it's all just CGI scripts or just, you know, gets and posts and whatnot. And so it should be, I would think, fairly trivial to write an interface on that. And that's actually a really good suggestion, because I know when this was announced, pretty much every store that I went to looking for it, they were all sold out. So I'm sure a lot of these units have been sold to people. And, you know, if they get annoyed enough with the interface, then somebody else is going to come up with a much better interface for it. And that should be fairly trivial to do, I would think.
Yeah, I wonder how many firmware revisions they've had since they released it that might fix some of this stuff too.
You know, that's a good point, and that's actually one of my bitches. It's a good thing, and it's still a bitch about my DVD player. Now, I bought my DVD player now almost a year and a half, well, over a year and a half ago now, and they do come out with firmware updates rather regularly for it. The only problem is oftentimes each firmware update fixes some stuff and at the same time breaks other stuff. And so it's been quite annoying. For a long while, my DVD player perfectly did upscaling to my high-def television, and then for some reason, with the last firmware update, that stopped working. It doesn't do upscaling anymore. It doesn't transmit the DVD signal as an HD format. And I don't know if they were illegally doing it before or there was some other problem with it, but I would think that would be okay. But, I mean, the player does work quite well, and I'm quite happy with it. The firmware update is kind of like an iffy thing. My hope is that this router, which, I'm assuming is running some variant of Linux, we'll have some sort of a following like the Linksys WRT54G, which was running Linux, and people hacked the crap out of that thing to put web servers and all sorts of crazy stuff on there. So hopefully, if this gets into if somebody can come up with some sort of open firmware, then I think that might be pretty exciting.
Well, in theory, now I'm thinking about it, there's no reason that you wouldn't be able to do all of this stuff with another open, open router, because everything that they're doing is essentially software services. So if you could get more storage onto it, then you should be able to do this with just about any router that you'd be able to hack properly. The trick would be getting storage in there.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. If you just somehow get an IDE interface on there, and again, this thing has three USB ports as well. Which, I don't know, sticking a memory stick into it doesn't seem all that exciting, but being able to hook up an external hard drive and doubling or tripling your capacity easily is pretty kick-ass. So if we can just get the Linksys routers with an IDE interface on there so we can slap on a hard drive, be set to go.
Well, these have actually GPL'd source code for the firmware, and the last update was actually in the beginning of August, so they're on 104.02. So it looks like it might be easily extendable by the user community. It just has to happen now.
Cool. I want to put MySQL on mine.
You would.
Yeah, if they GPL'd the firmware, now I'm interested.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been sitting here looking at my old PDA, and I bought this thing, I think, 4.5 years ago or so, and it's a Sharp Zorus SL3000, I think, or 3500 or something. I think it's just the 3000, but at any rate, it has has a CF card and an SD card, and I use the SD card for storage, and so I think I got a half gig card in there right now, and I'm just using Compact Flash. I've got an 802.11b card in there right now, but man, I've installed so much shit on that PDA. I've got a full GCC developers environment, which includes the Java compilers. I've got two other Java compilers and two other Java runtime environments. I've got Python, Perl, Lisp, MySQL, Apache with PHP on my fucking PDA, And I actually have it set up so that in an emergency, I can bring that online as a web server in case one of my servers goes down. And, it's just this tiny little thing, The only problem is it only has like 100 megahertz processor in it, so it's slower than heck. To do Perl with MySQL and some sort of web application isn't so great, but open firmware and Linux, it's lots of fun. Chris, have you thought about mucking around with your PDA? Well, you have a PDA phone. Are you basically using that as like a web and email client, or have you thought about actually putting any other resources on there?
Well, I'm running a Motorola Q, which is a mobile smartphone, Windows phone, I guess you could call it. And there actually is a bunch of utilities for smartphone that you can use, and I think there'll be even more now since there's actually a keyboard on this thing. It's not something you'd want to do a lot of command line stuff with, but I can't imagine that a CRT program isn't too far off now. And the plan I've got is unlimited data, so you could easily use it for Telnet. I'm not sure how it would handle SSH if the processor and the phone would be able to do it, but I'm assuming it would. But it's not nearly as capable as like a Linux-based PDA or like a compact iPack that's been made into a Linux-based PDA. There isn't that same level of extensibility. You can't just grab a package. Well, you can grab a package. Obviously, it has to be written by somebody else for it to happen, but porting isn't nearly as easy, and you have to have the whole Windows development kit and all of that. So as far as having something you can muck around with, you have to have an active user community, and something like the Sony PSP is starting to get an active user community because they keep reverse engineering the firmware so they can run homebrew games on it instead of just what Sony gives you. Well, and same thing with your PDA. It's only functional and useful for this long because there's an active user community, and it's been made so you can extend it. So,
yeah, I was actually just thinking here too. Is something that I can do. Well, maybe you could do this with the right hardware. I don't know, but because I do have a wired Compact Flash network interface controller for my PDA, so I can even hook it up to a wired network, and I've got TCP dump on there. I actually even have a very small, lightweight version of Ethereal, which is a graphical packet sniffer for my PDA. And I've actually used it. It kind of, sort of works. It's really hard to read because, you know, so many packets go by and whatnot. But it's a pretty cool little unit. And I actually feel bad because I haven't been using it as much anymore, mainly just because I've got my my Apple laptop now, which can pretty much do, you know, all the same stuff, and it's just slightly bulkier. But anyway, I digress here. But you know, having embedded Linux and having embedded systems on these devices, there's a lot of cool shit going on there. So, and I would bet, Chris, that you could be able to do SSH just fine. I mean, SSH has been optimized quite well nowadays. That it doesn't take a whole lot of processing power to do that encryption. So
I even had at one point some software where you could actually run a web server on one of these things, but I have no intention to doing that. That's in. I can't even imagine how well the phone would work after that, but it's kind of cool that you can.
Yeah, I don't want to think about your battery life if you're constantly walking around serving at web pages, no matter where you are from your phone. That doesn't seem like a very optimal solution there for a web server.
Well, and every time I got a phone call, the web server would go down, so.
Yeah. Yeah, not good.
Yeah, I still have a original 2-meg handspring visor, so no web servers for me.
Yeah, you're not missing out much, though. All right, well, let's move on here. There was a very interesting social engineering experiment done using USB flash drives, little pen drives that we all carry around nowadays. I think I have like 6 or 7 of these things, and they're pretty much replacing floppy drives for college students now. I know our lost and found pile at my where I work, there's oftentimes 1 or 2 or 3 even little USB drives left in the lost and found there that students forget in the public access machines. But in this particular example here, there was a bank hired a third-party firm to try to infiltrate the bank, I guess. I know Travis knows a little bit more about this, so I guess I'll let him talk about it. But and they came up with a very interesting solution for using social engineering to get into the bank. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about this, Travis?
Well, it was a credit union that hired a security firm, you know, to do some Tiger Team securities testing, and what the credit union said was that they specifically wanted them to test using social engineering because they had been training their employees on resisting those types of attacks. They wanted to see how well they were doing. And so what the firm did was they got a bunch of USB drives that they had gotten through trade shows and that sort of thing. You know, they weren't anything special, just, you know, small drives that had various logos on them. And they took 20 of them, loaded them with JPEGs that had a Trojan embedded in them that would gather password data and then email it back to the firm. So they took these and just scattered them around the grounds of the credit union, in the parking lot, on the sidewalk, you know, that sort of thing. And they just wanted to see how many of them would find their way into the machines inside the credit union. Of the 20 that they distributed, 15 of them were found, and all 15 of them found their way into employee machines. And within the day, they had security information flowing into the email address that they had set up, which I thought was really an interesting kind of twist to exploiting human curiosity. I wouldn't have thought of that, but apparently it worked really well.
Yeah, I myself actually do have a USB drive that I found in the street. And I just picked it up, and I believe I hate to say this, but I believe I did even put it into a Windows machine initially, but I didn't even look to see what was on it. I just, you know, erased it right away. So I guess that's one hint I guess we can tell our listeners. If you do find a USB drive, or your buddy gives you one, or whatnot, if you just come across one, even if you buy one in the store, actually, I don't know. I mean, for the most part, I do trust the manufacturers, but they do put a lot of crud on a lot of the flash drives when you get them right from the store. Just go and erase those suckers right off the bat, so you don't have to worry about anything. But in this particular case, just very ingenious thing to do, because you're preying almost on people's luck. You know, you're saying, hey, you know, it's like happy birthday, you know, here's a little present for you, something you find in the street or something you find in the parking lot. And I think I would probably be awfully tempted to just grab it and plug it in right away too. But again, I don't know if I'd actually I might be tempted to look at the images too. If I was smart, I'd transfer them to a Unix box first. But even, I don't know, do you know, did you have to view the image, or think even just transferring them perhaps could have set off the Trojan? I don't know.
Oh, I think that you actually had to view them. I would imagine that the Trojan, they didn't give a lot of details about the technical aspects of it, but I would assume that it exploited, you know, because there were some vulnerabilities in the JPEG viewer of Internet Explorer that I remember reading about. I would assume that it exploited a hole like that. So I would imagine you actually had to open the image and trigger the rendering of the JPEG. But the reason I thought it was so interesting is just because typically when you think about social engineering, you think about a skilled social engineer actually talking somebody into divulging information that that they're not supposed to. At this point, they didn't even have to talk to anybody. They didn't have to do anything. They just, you know, laid a couple of traps and just let people walk into them. I thought that was a kind of a novel approach to social engineering of just letting the users do all the work. You don't put yourself at risk at all.
Well, and this really speaks to what companies should be thinking about when we're talking about data getting in and out of the company and how to, you know, how far you should trust your users. You know, you need to do, you know, obviously need to do training for your employees, but you also need to protect yourself against stuff like this. So, for instance, Windows XP SP2 has a registry key that will allow you to prevent USB mass storage devices from automatically being recognized and starting up on Windows boxes. And that can go a long ways to protecting all the people that really shouldn't have a need for it. Like these people, odds are most of them did not have a need to have USB access, so prevent that. But there's other, you know, applications out on the market that'll be, you know, six digits plus that bigger companies look into that control your access to infrared ports and serial ports and parallel ports. Remember the old backpack drives on parallel ports? So there's lots of options to get data in and out of a machine, and companies need to be really careful about how and when they grant access to those things. Laptop manufacturers these days are including, you know, every different interface under the sun on a machine, but for most employees, you're only going to use one of those, you know, once every 3 months. So why have them enabled in the first place?
Well, that actually gets me thinking a little bit too about Windows doing auto run, and you know, I guess if I were these guys, yeah, I would have put the Trojan on those JPEG images, but for the heck of it, I would have put an auto run file on there as well in case that was set up, so that, you know, the instant the user plugged the drive into their machine, it would have auto run a script to set stuff up. Now, I'm assuming. Well, actually, I guess I don't know. Underneath Vista, I know this is going to change a bit, but underneath XP right now, if I have a Trojan on a USB drive, and all I need to do is, you know, to install that as a, I don't know, perhaps as a service or put it into some sort of a startup group item, which is again just a registry key, I might be able to do that, and not even, and the user may not even know anything had occurred. Chris, you know a bit more about this, but I'm sure you can answer. But I don't know. Do you guys turn off auto run? I know I do, and also that was a big thing with the Sony rootkit a while back. Because if you just held down the shift key when you put in your CD, it wouldn't do the auto run, and so you could kind of get around their little wacky DRM thing. But isn't auto run a bit of a security risk?
Well, absolutely, because you're assuming that you want to run that, and you know, there's that danger between having the person read the manual and learning they have to double click on setup, or having them just put the CD and start everything off for them. And so you know, again, for businesses, you shouldn't have that stuff enabled. And even for consumers, if you're slightly concerned, shut off auto run and just go double click on the setup yourself, so that way you know, when you put in media, you know where it came from, you can go run it rather than somebody bringing you over a CD and stuff running automatically on your machine, you know. So I actually have it disabled because it doesn't play well with VMware, because of course it's trying to use the same hardware. So
is there a quick and easy way to do that? I think usually you have to put something in And then the auto, you know, the box will come up and say, do you want to automatically run this? And you have to say no or something like that. But is there a dialog box in the control panel somewhere where I can just disable auto run for every device?
Yeah, actually, you can go into, if you could just right-click on the CD drive, there's an autoplay tab in XP that you can tell Windows what to do on every type of, I guess that's every type of files it finds on it. I wonder if there's a way to disable it in there. I know how to do it through the registry, but I'm not sure how you do it through here.
Yeah, I know how to do it on a device-specific level, but I'm not sure if you can do it on a system level.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what Travis just said. That's what I've observed, and I guess that's slightly annoying because if you want to plug something in, well, you have to attach some device of some sort, and then after it's attached, then turn off auto run. It'd be nice if you could somehow disable that altogether.
Well, you can do it. You can disable it without actually putting something in, but just by going to the into the system properties, the device manager.
But what I'm thinking about is that it's typically assigned along with the drive letter, usually. So let's say that my buddy has his USB drive configured to be drive...
Oh, you're talking about USB
T.
drives. I was thinking CD, like optical drives.
Yeah, that should be fairly trivial to do, yeah, because that's already connected and you can configure that without any without a disk in there. But for USB drives and other drives, you know, you hook up an external hard drive or something along those lines, I think it always looks for that auto run file, and it'd be nice to just turn that off. The other thing I'm annoyed by is actually when I hook up my digital camera, sometimes it wants to run Photoshop or some other thing, and I'm like, no, I'll figure that out on my own. So I just want to turn all that crap off.
The only registry key I found is for the CD-ROM service, so that's a good question. How do you disable it for USB devices? And that's even, you know, now there's a new U3 standard of USB devices that have like a partition on your USB device that'll actually have protected content. So vendors are starting to give those away, so that way you can't reuse the entire flash for your own. You can't wipe out the entire thing. You can only wipe out part of it for your content, and the rest of it is their garbage. Really?
Now, is that like vendors giving away flash drives with, like, you know, like, here's our sample program or something like that, and it's like read-only or something along those lines, or what's
exactly
the purpose of
presentations? Gotcha. Really, that type
gotcha,
of thing.
Gotcha. Which isn't so bad. I mean, that's you think a CD would be cheaper, but I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit of a more of a cool factor there if your vendor hands you a USB, a little USB pen drive and says, here's our demo software. So. Well, hopefully we can figure out eventually here how to turn that off, because that'd be rather nice. All right, well, in other news here, there was finally, after the demise of HIM, which was a program that worked back in the iTunes 4 days, I believe, was the last time it worked, although iTunes 5 was very short-lived and immediately went to 6 pretty much. But for a long while now, if you wanted to basically break any of your DRM... break the DRM on any of the songs that you buy through iTunes, your only option was to burn it to a CD and re-rip it, and then, of course, to copy over or move over all of the metadata, including the album art cover and the song and album name and all that jazz. Well, there's finally a new thing out called MyTunes, and actually shortly after that came out, MyTunes was a command line Python script, which apparently was not too easy to run, but would actually do the job. But now there is actually a thing called MyFairTunes, which works with the latest versions of iTunes and will basically remove the DRM from your audio and also copy over a lot of the metadata. Now, my question with this is if you actually look at the way it works, you have to play all of your music for it to work. And I'm just wondering, is that actually breaking the DRM, or is it just, playing it and using audio drivers to capture the audio output and re-encoding that as an MP3? Or some other various format. There's like some interim format. I guess I didn't look too deeply into this because I actually don't buy any music through iTunes. I get my my free Tuesday music, but that's the only thing that I actually ever click on the buy button for. But it's nice to I don't want to say it's nice to see that this is broken, but it does show towards the persistence of people out there and the fact that they don't like DRM and they don't want to have DRM music. Because it's fucking annoying.
It does appear to actually break... I don't know if it so much breaks the DRM, but it does strip the DRM from the file. I don't think that it exploits the analog hole. Now, why it has to do it in real time, I don't know. I could be wrong. But what it does do is it appears it strips the DRM into a just straight the data from the AAC, and then you basically have to reconstitute that into a playable AAC. So that appears to be actually stripping the DRM.
That's good then, I guess. And as to why it requires real-time encoding, maybe it's a really crappy algorithm they're using in there or something. Who knows? But I do know it is basically you do have to basically play your library. And you know, they were saying, well, it's not too bad. Just set it up before you go to bed at night, and you get, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you'll have 8 hours of un-DRM'd audio file ready for you, which isn't too bad, I guess. I don't know how extensive my library is. I don't even know how many music files I have on my computers nowadays. I think about 10 gigs worth, and I don't know
well,
how many hours
to,
of play
you only have
is,
to do this to the ones that are DRM encoded, though. You don't have to do this.
Absolutely.
Keep that in mind.
Yep. But I'm just saying, if my library was all purchased and I had 10 gigabytes of audio, that may take a rather significant amount of time. But even if it's a week, and then once that's done, then it's only the new stuff that you got to worry about.
Yeah, and it looks like the one for Windows Media, Fair Use 4WM, that also actually does strip the DRM. It's not an analog hole exploit.
Now, do you know the Fair Use 4WM, what all services that that sell music files does that work for? You know, I know Napster does WMAs, but do you know, does it work with any of those services, or?
Well, pretty much anybody that doesn't that isn't the iTunes Music Store, because really it's the only other widely used DRM. So that would include Napster, that would include Rhapsody from Real Networks, that would include you know, pretty much everybody except for iTunes. Sony has their own, so they're Connect whatever that doesn't really exist much anymore, so that doesn't work. But
the one article I've seen said that like Yahoo Music is another one, and it did successfully do Napster, but it couldn't rip the Vongo videos, so it might be hit or miss.
Yeah, video is a whole other question mark here. So if you're downloading videos, either music videos or TV shows, and the big rumor, which will probably be divulged by the time this podcast comes out, because I think it's in 2 or 3 days here, is when Apple's doing some other big thing, and the rumor mill is that they're going to be selling movies on iTunes for the, I believe, ridiculous price. They're actually movie rentals. I don't even think you can buy movies. But of course, this is all rumors, you know, so who knows. But the price supposedly was $15. Now, if I'm paying $15 for something, I better goddamn own it afterwards if it's a movie. I'm paying $15 to rent a movie. That's ridiculous.
No, I think you can. I think you're actually buying the movie, but yeah, it is somewhere between $10 or $15 from the rumor mill that I've.
Yeah, and of course, neither of these applications apparently work with video right now, and so that's a whole other mix right there. And of course, there is a little bit of an analog hole there, because you can use a screen grabbing utility to re-encode the video, and of course, you know, you can use an application like Audacity or something else to capture the audio, but that's a lot of work to get around that. Of course, your quality goes to crap afterwards as well. A little bit while on video yet here, but at least there's some audio solutions out there for us now.
Well, I don't know. From what I'm reading in this, Windows Media, the actual Fair Use from Windows Media, it might actually strip the DRM off of video too, but we'll see.
Well, if that works, that's rather interesting. Well, you know, related to all this, actually, there was some sort of an article came out, and the way I saw it kind of had a little bit of a skew to it, and it said that Microsoft, they found a hole in the DRM code and released a patch for it within 3 days of finding out about the exploit. And the article I read was, you know, basically skewing Microsoft into a negative viewpoint by saying, you know, hey, you know, when there's money on the line, you know, they come out with a solution, you know, as fast as they possibly can, but when it's, you know, your security on the line, they'll wait a couple of weeks. You saw that article too, didn't you, Chris?
Yeah, they were quick to turn that around because, and I'm not sure if it was in response to this or not. It came out soon after this, so I expect that it was. And actually, I've got another article that talks about the Windows Media being updated in response to the software tool that would allow you to decrypt it. So I think they're one and the same, but I haven't really confirmed that. But yeah, they, of course, Microsoft has got partnerships with all of these content providers to provide WMVs or NWMAs, audio and video files, in a licensable format. So these content providers will have the faith in the Microsoft standard to protect their content. So this is a big issue for them and a big potential disaster for their revenue stream in this whole area if there's a way to strip off the DRM.
Now, isn't it usually standard fare that if there's some sort of a security patch, and I'm assuming that's the way this is going to be distributed, can't I go into my Add Remove Programs dialog box and click on a little button that says Show Me All Updates and selectively click on one of those and just uninstall it? Or if I use the automatic update and I tell it to always prompt me for it, I think there's a custom button that I can click on and just never install the update for this. Or if I did install it, is there the possibility that I can uninstall it and get the broken version that allows me to get around their security fix and to continue to use the fair use for WM application?
Well, exactly. I'm not sure how this update is supposed to come out, because in the this next Tuesday is Patch Tuesday. There's going to be, and you'll probably know this by then, but there'll be three updates. I believe two of them for Windows and one's for Office. So one of those Windows ones could actually be for Windows Media Player, and then it's up to if they install it the same way that everybody else does, you'll have the ability to remove that. But this is actually a media player update, so I don't think they could do it like a codec update where it's separate from your program files. It would have to be listed. So odds are you'll be able to remove it, even if they do add it here.
Well, and even if it isn't conveniently in the Add Remove Programs dialog box, somebody out there is going to copy their old version of Media Player in the various libraries and put those up on an FTP site somewhere and say, hey, if you accidentally installed the update, just go grab these files and slap them on your machine and you'll get around it again.
Well, and I'm happy to report that my machine does not have the newer version yet, so yay!
But you don't subscribe to any of those services anyways, though, correct?
No, I really don't. But every once in a while, you run across some file that's, some demo file that you got from a serial box to download one piece of content, and you get it, and all of a sudden the license runs out. So this will be fun to play with.
This actually reminds me about something. My buddy Brian, he was using one of these services. They were actually, I don't remember the name of them, but they were bought out by somebody else. And he had purchased, I don't know how many songs from them. And it wasn't like Napster. It was more like iTunes, where you paid them, and then you were able to play the file indefinitely on your computer. And you could, there was very similar things as to what iTunes has. You could burn it like five times or something like that. But he had a collection of a good fair-sized amount of songs. I believe 200 or so songs that he had purchased from this company. And like I said, they were bought out by somebody else, and then he accidentally had deleted his licensing files that were local on his computer. And so he called them up and said, hey, can I get my license file back? And they said, well, we've been bought out by somebody else. And he said, well, what do I do? And they're like, well, we can send you a check. And he said, okay. And so they sent him a check for all of the songs that he had bought. So he basically got all of his money back, which was pretty nice for the company to do, I thought.
No kidding.
Yeah,
that's unusual.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you think about it, usually you would think, especially like if iTunes, if you download a song, you purchase a song and download it, obviously, if you delete that, your local copy, I believe there is like some option in iTunes where they will allow you to download that song one more additional time and not charge you for it again. But if you lose it again after that, you're screwed. They don't keep records of every purchase that you make and allow you to just download those to any machine and listen to them on any machine, regardless of where you're at. Obviously, if you download it once, you can move it from machine to machine. As long as you log in, you're all okay. But for them to just say, well, we'll just give you your money back, this is very generous of them, I thought. So,
yeah, at this point, I'd like to mention that eMusic not only lets you download songs that you've purchased as many times as you want, but it keeps a list for easy access. So it keeps a list of what you've downloaded, and then has a link so you can download them easily.
You know, that's so trivial to do too. I mean, it's not a very complicated list. You know, it's basically just, you know, it's going to be a key in their database, you know, so it's going to be some number that they just store somewhere. And for them to be able to store that and have that for you is trivial and means a lot to the consumers, I think. So, yeah, I mean, that should be a service, that should be a de facto service for iTunes and any other service.
Yeah, you can see why I'm an eMusic fanboy.
Well, yeah, plus it's non-DRM music, so that's awfully nice, too. Well, that should do it for this episode. On behalf of Chris Grant and Travis Crow, I'm Nem Schleck. Thanks for listening to Geek Muse. If you'd like more information on the topics we discussed, or if you leave us a question or comment, please visit geekmuse.net. That's geekmuse.net. Or shoot us an email at geekmuse@gmail.com. And, of course, if you come out to the blog, we always have the show notes out there, and we do appreciate people coming out leaving comments. And I think we're pretty good about answering people's comments. Maybe we could be a little bit better at that, but for the most part, we usually do get back to you. Also, if you'd like to send us a voicemail, download Gizmo from gizmoproject.com and leave your name, location, and question or comment with username GeekMuse, and you'll probably be in our next podcast. Thanks again, everybody.